lay the groundwork. At least, I thought that's what he meant. Either that or you farm the fields. Since Njord was a god of crops, I couldn't be sure. Hearthstone touched his scarf. He signed, reluctantly, "The stone?" Njord nodded. "You know where you must look for it." Blitzen broke into the conversation, signing so fast his words got a little muddled. "Leave my elf alone. We can't do that again. Too dangerous." Or he could have meant, "Leave my elf in the bathroom. We can't do that wristwatch. Too much garbage." "What are you guys talking about?" I asked. My spoken words sounded jarring and unwelcome in the silent dialogue. Blitzen brushed his chainmail vest. "Our long-range reconnaissance work, kid. Mimir told us to look for the mead of Kvasir. Then we heard rumors about a certain item we'd need. Bulwark's whetstone," I guessed. He nodded unhappily. "It's the only way to defeat..." He spread his hands. "Whatever's guarding the mead. We're not clear on the who, how, or why." Those all seemed like pretty important points to me. "The thing is," Blitz continued, "if this stone is where we think it is..." "It's all right," Hearthstone signed. "We must. So we will." "Buddy, no," Blitz said. "You can't..."
"The elf is right," Njord said. "You two must find the stone while Magnus and the rest of the crew sail on to discover the location of the mead. Are you ready?"
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," I said. "You're sending them away right now? They just got here."
"Grandson, you have very little time before Loki's ship is ready to sail. Only by dividing can you conquer."
I was pretty sure the old divide and conquer saying meant that the divided army got conquered. But Njord didn't sound like he was in the mood for a debate. "Let me go instead." I staggered to my feet. I just had the longest day in the history of days. I was ready to fall over. But there was no way I was going to stand by while my two oldest friends got sent into mortal danger. "Or at least let me go with them."
"Kid," Blitz said, his voice cracking, "it's okay."
"My burden," Hearth signed, both hands pushing down on one of his shoulders. Njord gave me another calm smile. I was about ready to punch in my grandfather's perfect teeth.
"The crew of this ship will need you with them, Magnus," he said. "But I promise you this. Once Hearthstone and Blitzen have found the location of the whetstone, once they have laid the groundwork for the assault, I will send them back to get you. Then the three of you can face the true danger together. If you fail, you'll die as a team. How is that?"
That didn't make me yell hooray, but I figured it was the best offer I was going to get. "All right." I helped Blitz to his feet and gave him a hug. He smelled like toasted kelp and dwarf noir eau de toilette. "Don't you dare die without me."
"Do my best, kid."
I faced Hearthstone. I put my hand gently on his chest, an elfish gesture of deep affection. "You," I signed, "safe. Or me, angry." The corners of his mouth pulled upward, though he still looked distracted and worried. His heartbeat fluttered under my fingertips like a scared dove. "You too," he signed. Njord snapped his fingers, and my friends broke into sea spray, like waves crashing against the bow. I swallowed down my anger. I told myself, Njord had only sent Hearth and Blitz away. He hadn't actually vaporized them. He'd promised I would see them again. I had to believe that. "Now what?" I asked him. "What do I do while they're gone?"
Ah.
Njord crossed his legs in lotus position, probably just to show off the soles of his wave-sculpted feet.
Your task is equally difficult, Magnus. You must discover the location of Kvasir's mead. This is a closely guarded secret, known only to a few giants. But there is one who might be convinced to tell you. Hrungnir, who prowls the human land of Jorvik.
The ship hit a swell, jarring my stomach loose from its undercarriage. I've had some bad encounters with giants.
Haven't we all? Njord said. Once you reach Jorvik, you must find Hrungnir and challenge him. If you beat him, demand that he give you the information you need.
I shuddered, thinking about the last time I was in Jotunheim. Please tell me this challenge won't be a bowling tournament.
Oh no, rest easy, Njord said. It will most likely be personal combat to the death. You should bring a couple of friends along. I would recommend the attractive one, Alex Fierro.
I wondered if Alex would be flattered by that, or grossed out, or if she'd just laugh. I wondered if Alex's feet were as well-groomed as Njord's. What a stupid thing to wonder about.
Okay, I said. Jorvik. Wherever that is. Your ship knows the way, Njord promised. I can grant you safe passage that far, but if you survive and sail onward, your ship will once again be vulnerable to attack by Aegir, Ran, their daughters, or worse things.
I will try to contain my happiness.
That's wise, Njord said. Your elf and dwarf will find the whetstone you require. You will discover the secret location of the mead. Then you will retrieve the mead of Kvasir, defeat Loki, and return him to his chains.
I appreciate the vote of confidence.
Well, it's more that if you don't, Loki will flight you into a pathetic, powerless shadow of yourself. Then you will have to watch all your friends die, one by one, until you alone are left to suffer in Helheim for eternity while the nine worlds burn. That is Loki's plan.
Oh.
Anyway, Njord said brightly. Good luck!
My grandfather exploded in a fine sea mist, splattering my face with salt. Chapter 14. Nothing happens. It's a miracle. Smooth sailing. I never appreciated that term until I'd actually had some. The next 2 days were shockingly, perversely uneventful. The sky remained cloudless, the winds gentle and cool. The sea stretched in all directions like green silk, reminding me of pictures my mom used to show me from her favorite artist, this dude named Christo, who worked outside and wrapped entire forests, buildings, and islands in shimmering cloth. It looked like Christo had turned the North Atlantic into one huge art installation. The Big Banana sailed merrily onward. Our yellow oars churned by themselves. The sail tacked and jibed as needed. When I told the crew we were going to Jorvik, Halfborn grunted unhappily. But whatever he knew about the place, he wouldn't share. At least the ship seemed to understand where we were heading. The second afternoon, I found myself standing amidships with Mallory Keene, who'd been acting even more disgruntled than usual.
I still don't understand why Blitz and Hearth had to leave, she grumbled.
I had a sneaking suspicion Miss Keene had a crush on Blitzen, but I was not brave enough to ask. Every time Blitz visited Valhalla, I would catch Mallory checking out his immaculate beard and perfect outfit, then glancing at Halfborn Gunderson as if wondering why her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, re-boyfriend, ex-boyfriend couldn't dress so nattily. Niord swore it was necessary, I said, though I'd been doing little else but worrying about Blitz and Hearth. Something about maximizing our time.
Humph.
Mallory waved at the horizon.
Yet here we are, sailing and sailing. Your grandpa couldn't have just zapped us to Jorvik. That would have been more useful.
Halfborn Gunderson walked by with a mop and bucket.
Useful, he muttered. Unlike some people.
Shut up and swab, Mallory snapped. As for you, Magnus, I warned you about taking Loki's bait. And what did you do? Stepped up and volunteered for a flighting. You're as stupid as this berserker.
With that, she climbed to the top of the mast, the most solitary place on the ship, and proceeded to glare daggers at the ocean. Halfborn mumbled as he swabbed the deck.
Red-headed Irish vixen. Pay her no mind, Magnus.
I wished we didn't have to make our voyage while the two of them were feuding. Or while Sam was fasting for Ramadan. Or while Alex was trying to teach Sam how to foil Loki's control. Come to think of it, I wished we didn't have to make this voyage at all. What's Mallory's history with Loki? I asked. She seems... I wasn't sure which word to use. Worried? Resentful? Homicidal? Halfborn nodded his shoulders, making the serpent tattoos undulate across his back. He glanced at the top of the mast, as if considering more curse words at Mallory's expense.
Not my place to say, but being baited into doing something you later regret, Mallory knows about that. It's how she died.
I thought back to my first days in Valhalla, when Halfborn had teased Mallory for trying to disarm a car bomb with her face. Her death must have had more to it. She'd been brave enough to attract the attention of a Valkyrie.
Magnus, you've got to understand, Halfborn said. We're both heading toward the places where we died. It may be different for you. You died in Boston, stayed in Boston. You haven't been dead long enough to see the world change around you. But for us, Mallory's got no wish to see Ireland again, even if we just sail past its shores. And me, I never wanted to return to Jorvik.
I felt a pang of guilt. Man, I'm sorry. Is that where you died?
Not the exact spot, but close. I helped conquer the city with Ivar the Boneless. It served as our base camp. Not much of a town back in the day. I just hope they don't still have Vatnavatir in the river.
He shuddered.
Bad.
I had no idea what Vatnavatir were, but if Halfborn Gunderson considered them bad, I did not want to meet them. Later that evening, I checked in on TJ, who was standing at the prow, staring over the waves, drinking coffee, and nibbling a piece of hardtack. Why he liked hardtack, I couldn't tell you. It was like a big saltine cracker made with cement instead of flour, and no salt. Hey, I said. He had trouble focusing on me.
Oh, hey, Magnus.
He offered me a cement cracker. Want one? I'm good, thanks. I might need my teeth later on. He nodded as if he hadn't gotten the joke. Ever since I'd told the crew about my conversation with Niord, TJ had been quiet and withdrawn, about as close as he ever got to brooding. He dipped his hardtack in the coffee. I've always wanted to go to England. I just never thought it would be after I was dead, on a quest, on a bright yellow warship. England? That's where we're heading. Didn't you know? When I thought about England, which wasn't very often, I thought of the Beatles, Mary Poppins, and guys wearing bowler hats, carrying umbrellas, and saying, "Pip, pip, cheerio." I didn't think about hordes of Vikings or places called Jorvik. Then I remembered that when I first met Halfborn Gunderson, he told me he died invading East Anglia. That had been a kingdom in England, like 1,200 years ago. Those Vikings really got around. TJ leaned on the rail. In the moonlight, a thin streak of amber glowed across his neck, the path of a minié ball that had grazed him during his first battle as a Union Army soldier. It seemed strange to me that you could die, reach Valhalla, get resurrected daily for 150 years, and still carry a tiny scar you got in your mortal life. Back in the war, he said, we all worried that Great Britain would declare for the rebels. The British had abolished slavery way before we did. The Union, I mean. But they needed southern cotton for their textile mills. The fact that the UK stayed neutral and didn't side with the South, that was a huge factor in the North winning the war. It always gave me a warm feeling toward the Brits. I dreamed about going there someday and saying thank you in person. I tried to detect sarcasm or irony in his tone. TJ was the son of a freed slave. He'd fought and died for a country that kept his family in chains for generations. He even carried the name of a famous slaveholder. But TJ said we when he talked about the Union. He wore his uniform proudly after more than a century. He dreamed about crossing the ocean to thank the British just because they'd done him the favor of staying neutral. How do you always find the bright side? I marveled. You're so positive. TJ laughed, nearly choking on his hardtack. Magnus, buddy, if you'd seen me right after I got to Valhalla, nah. Those first few years were rough. Union soldiers weren't the only ones who made it to Valhalla. Plenty of rebels died with swords in their hands. Valkyries don't care which side of the war you fight on, or how just your cause is. They look for personal bravery and honor. There. Just a hint of disapproval in his voice. First couple of years I was in An Her Ye, I saw some familiar faces come through the feast hall. How did you die? I asked. The real story. He traced the rim of his cup. Told you. Charging the battlements at Fort Wagner, South Carolina. There's more to it. A few days ago, you warned me about accepting challenges. You talked like you had personal experience. I studied the line of TJ's jaw, the tension bottled up there. Maybe that was why he liked hardtack. It gave him something difficult to grind his teeth against. A Confederate lieutenant singled me out, he said at last. I have no idea why. Our regiment was hunkered down, waiting for the order to charge the battlements. The enemy fire was withering. None of us could move. He glanced over. And then this Reb officer stood up on the enemy lines. He pointed across no man's land with his sword, right at me, like somehow he knew me. He shouted, Well, you can guess what he called me. Come out and fight me, man to man. Which would have been suicide. I prefer to think of it as a hopeless display of bravery. You mean you did it? His coffee cup trembled between his hands. The piece of hardtack in it started to dissolve, expanding like a sponge, brown liquid soaking into the white starch. When you're a child of Tyr, he said, you can't turn down a personal duel. Somebody says, fight me, and you do it. Every muscle in my body responded to that challenge. Believe me, I didn't want to go one-on-one with that guy. He'd obviously been thinking of a word other than guy. But I couldn't refuse. I went over the top, charged the Reb fortifications all by myself. I heard later, after I was dead, that my action triggered the offensive that led to the fall of Fort Wagner. The rest of the fellows followed my example. Guess they figured I was so crazy, they'd better back me up. Me, I just wanted to kill that lieutenant.
I did, too. Geoffrey Toussaint. Shot him once in the chest, then got close enough to jab my bayonet right into his gut. Of course, by then, the Rebs had shot me about 30 times. I fell in their ranks, and died smiling up at a bunch of angry Confederate faces. Next thing I knew, I was in Valhalla.
Odin's undies, I muttered, which was a curse I saved for special occasions.
Wait, the lieutenant you killed, how did you learn his name?
TJ gave me a rueful smile. Finally, I understood.
He ended up in Valhalla, too.
TJ nodded.
Floor 76. Me and old Geoffrey. We spent about 50 years killing each other over and over again every day. I was so filled with hate. That man was everything I despised, and vice versa. I was afraid we'd end up like Hunding and Helgi, immortal enemies still sniping at each other thousands of years later.
But you didn't?
Funny thing. Eventually, I just got tired of it. I stopped looking for Geoffrey Toussaint on the battlefield. I figured something out. You can't hold on to hate forever. It won't do a thing to the person you hate, but it'll poison you, sure enough. He traced the mini-A-ball scar with his finger. As for Geoffrey, he stopped showing up in the feast hall. Never saw him again. That happened to a lot of the Confederate and Harriar. They didn't last. They locked themselves in their rooms, never came out. They faded away. TJ shrugged and continued. I guess it was harder for them to adjust. You think the world is one way, then you find out it's much bigger and stranger than you ever imagined. If you can't expand your thinking, you're not going to do well in the afterlife. I recalled standing with Amir Fadlan on the rooftop of the Sitgo building, cradling his head and willing his mortal mind not to fracture under the weight of seeing the Bifrost Bridge and the Nine Worlds.
Yeah, I agreed. Expanding your brain hurts.
TJ smiled, but I no longer thought of it as an easy smile. It was hard won, as courageous as a solitary soldier charging enemy lines. You've accepted your own personal challenge now, Magnus. You're going to have to face Loki one-on-one. There's no going back. But if it helps, you won't be charging those fortifications by yourself. We'll be right there with you. He patted my shoulder. Now, if you'll excuse me. He handed me his coffee and hardtack soup like this was a fantastic gift. I'm off to get some shut-eye. Most of the crew slept below decks. The big banana, we had discovered, would unfold as many rooms as we needed to be comfortable, regardless of the exterior size of the hull. I wasn't sure how that worked. Even though I was a Doctor Who fan, I didn't feel like testing the limits of our bright yellow TARDIS. I preferred sleeping on the deck, under the stars, which is where I was on our third morning at sea, when Alex shook me awake.
"Let's go, Chase," she announced. "We're running Samira through her paces. I'm going to teach her how to defy Loki, even if it kills us. And by us, I mean you."
Chapter 15. Monkey. I saw my problem immediately. I should never have introduced Alex to Percy Jackson. She had learned way too much from his relentless training methods. Maybe Alex couldn't summon sea animals, but she could turn into them. That was just as bad. We started with Samira and Alex fighting each other, on the deck, in the water, in the air. My job was to call out random animals from a stack of flashcards Alex had made. I'd shout, "Monkey!" And Sam was supposed to turn into a monkey mid-combat, while Alex shapeshifted continually from human to animal to human,
doing her best to beat up Sam. Whenever Alex was in human form, she tossed out taunts like, "Come on, Al-Abbas, you call that a cotton-topped tamarin? Do better!" After an hour of combat charades, Samira's face gleamed with sweat. She'd taken off her hijab and tied back her long brown hair so she could fight better. She considered us all family, so she had no problem going hijabless when required. She leaned against the rail, taking a breather. I almost offered her some water. Then I remembered she was fasting. "Maybe we should take a break until tonight," I suggested. "After dark, you can eat and drink. This must be killing you."
"I'm fine."
Sam wasn't a very good liar, but she forced a smile.
"Thanks, though."
Alex paced the deck, consulting her clipboard. A clipboard, y'all. Like she was gunning to be assistant manager at the Hotel Valhalla. She wore green skinny jeans with a pink tank top, the front stitched with an inappropriate hand gesture in glittery sequins. Her hair had started to grow out, the black roots making her look even more imposing, like a lion with a healthy mane.
"Okay, Magnus, your turn," she told me. "Get Jack and prepare to fight."
Jack was pleased to help.
"Combat time? Cool!"
He floated in a circle around me.
"Who are we fighting?"
"Sam," I said. Jack froze.
"But I like Sam."
"We're just practicing," I said. "Try to kill her without really killing her."
"Oh, phew. Okay, I can do that."
Alex had a clicker. Her cruelty knew no bounds. Jack and I double-teamed Sam, Jack attacking with his blade, obviously, me with a mop handle, which I doubt struck terror into Sam's heart. Sam dodged and weaved and tried to land hits on us with her axe, the blade wrapped in sail canvas. Sam was supposed to shapeshift whenever Alex clicked her clicker, which she did at random intervals with no regard for Sam's situation. The idea, I guessed, was to condition Samira to change shape whenever, wherever she had to, without second-guessing herself. Jack held back, I could tell. He only whacked Sam a couple of times. Me? I was less than successful with my mop. Combat maneuvering on the deck of a Viking ship turned out to be one of the many important skills I did not have. I tripped over the oars. I got snagged in the rigging. Twice, I bonked my head on the mast and fell into the ocean. About average for me, in other words. Sam had no such trouble. She left me bruised and battered. The only time I landed a hit was when Alex clicked at a particularly bad time. Mid-lunge, Sam turned into a parrot and flew beak-first into my mop handle. She squawked, turned back into a human, and sat down hard on the deck, a cloud of blue and red feathers fluttering around her. "Sorry, Sam," I felt mortified. "I've never hit a parrot before." Despite her bloody nose, she laughed.
"It's fine. Let's try that again."
We fought until we were both spent. Alex called our practice done, and the three of us slumped against the rail shields.
"Woo!" Jack propped himself next to me. "I'm exhausted."
Since all the energy he expended would come out of me as soon as I took hold of him, I decided to let Jack stay in blade form a while longer. I wasn't ready to go comatose until after I had lunch. But at least I could have lunch. I glanced at Samira. "This Ramadan thing, I seriously don't know how you do it." She raised an eyebrow.
"You mean why I do it?"
"That too. You really have to endure the fast for a whole month?"
"Yes, Magnus," she said. "It may surprise you to learn that the month of Ramadan lasts 1 month."
"Glad you haven't completely lost your snark." She dabbed her face with a towel, which was apparently not forbidden.
"I'm more than halfway through the month. It's not so bad."
She frowned. Of course, if we all die before the end of Ramadan, that would be irritating.
Yeah, Alex agreed. Loki burns down the 9 worlds while you're fasting, and you can't even have a drink of water? Ouch.
Sam swatted her arm.
You have to admit, Fiero, I was more focused today. Ramadan helps.
Maybe, Alex said. I still think you're crazy to fast, but I'm not as worried as I was.
I feel clearer, Sam said. Emptier, in a good way. I'm not freezing up as much. I'll be ready when I face Loki, inshallah.
Sam didn't use that term much, but I knew it meant God willing. Though it obviously helped her, it never inspired much confidence in me. I'm going to do great, inshallah, was sort of like saying, I'm going to do great, assuming I don't get run over by a truck first.
Well, Alex said, we won't know what'll happen until you're facing dear old mom slash dad. But I'm cautiously optimistic. And you didn't kill Magnus, which I suppose is good.
Thanks, I muttered. Even that little bit of consideration from Alex, the idea that my death might be slightly disagreeable to her, gave me a warm and fuzzy feeling. Yeesh, I was pathetic.
The rest of the afternoon, I helped out around the Big Banana. Despite the automatic sailing, there was still plenty to do. Swapping decks, untangling lines, preventing Mallory and Halfborn from killing each other. The chores kept me from thinking too much about my impending confrontation with Loki, or what Blitz and Hearth might be up to. They'd already been gone 3 days, and we now had just under 2 weeks until Midsummer, maybe even less time until the ice melted enough to let Loki's ship sail. How long could it take Blitz and Hearth to find a rock? Naturally, the idea of searching for a whetstone brought back bad memories of my last quest with Blitz and Hearth, when we'd been trying to find the Skofnung stone. I told myself there was no connection. This time there would be no brutal Alfheim sunlight, no evil violin-playing Nox, no scowling, sadistic elf father. Soon, Hearth and Blitz would come back and report on a completely different set of dangerous obstacles for us to overcome. Every time a wave broke over the bow, I watched the sea spray, hoping it would solidify into my friends. But they did not reappear. A couple of times during the afternoon, small sea serpents swam by, like 20-footers. They eyed the ship, but didn't attack. I guessed they either didn't like banana-flavored prey, or were scared off by Jack singing. Jack followed me around the deck, alternating between ABBA hits, Vikings are huge ABBA fans, and telling me stories about the old days when he and Frey would roam the 9 worlds, spreading sunshine and happiness, and occasionally killing people. As the day wore on, this became a personal test of endurance. Did I want to return Jack to Runestone form and pass out from the toll of our combined exertions? Or did I want to listen to him sing some more? Finally, around sunset, I couldn't stand it any longer. I stumbled aft to where I'd set up my sleeping bag. I lay down, enjoying the sound of Samira doing her evening prayer on the foredeck, the sing-song poetry soft and relaxing. It seemed strange. The Muslim Maghrib prayer aboard a Viking ship full of atheists and pagans. Then again, Samira's ancestors had been dealing with Vikings since the Middle Ages. I doubted this was the first time prayers to Allah had been said aboard a longship. The worlds were a lot more interesting because of constant intermixing. I returned Jack to runestone form, and barely had time to reattach him to my neck chain before I passed out. In my dreams, I got to witness a murder. Chapter 16. Spitman versus Chainsaw. Guess who wins? I stood with 4 gods at the crest of a hill, next to the ruins of a thatched hut. Odin leaned on a thick oaken staff, chainmail glinting under his blue travel cloak. A spear was strapped across his back. A sword hung at his side. His one good eye gleamed under the shade of his blue, wide-brimmed hat. With his grizzled beard, eye patch, and assorted weapons, he looked like a guy who couldn't decide whether to go to a Halloween party as a wizard or a pirate. Next to him stood Heimdall, the guardian of the Beef Roast Bridge. Smartphones must not have been invented yet, because he wasn't doing his usual thing of taking pictures every 5 seconds. He was dressed in armor of thick white wool, with two swords sheathed in an X across his back. Gialar, the Horn of Doomsday, dangled from his belt, which didn't strike me as very safe. Anybody could have run up behind him, blown that horn, and started Ragnarok as a practical joke. The third god, my father, Frey, knelt next to the ashes of a campfire. He wore faded jeans and a flannel shirt, though I didn't see how those clothes could have been invented yet. Maybe Frey was a medieval beta tester for REI. His blonde hair swept across his shoulders. His bristly beard glowed in the sunlight. If there had been any justice in the world, the thunder god Thor would have looked like this. Blonde and handsome and regal. Not like a muscle-bound red-headed fart machine. The fourth god I had never met, but I recognized him from Njord's holographic show-and-tell. Kvasir, the living peace treaty between Aesir and Vanir. He was a handsome guy, considering that he originated as a cup of divine spit. His dark, curly hair and beard rippled in the breeze. Homespun robes enfolded him, giving him that Jedi Master vibe. He knelt next to my father, his fingers hovering over the charred remnants of the campfire. Odin leaned toward him.
"What do you think, Kvasir?"
That question alone told me how much the gods respected Kvasir. Normally, Odin did not ask for the opinions of others. He simply gave answers, usually in the form of riddles or PowerPoint presentations. Kvasir touched the ashes.
"This is Loki's fire, all right. He was here recently. He is still close by."
Heimdall scanned the horizon.
"I don't see him anywhere in a 500-mile radius, unless... No, that's an Irishman with a nice haircut."
"We must catch Loki," Odin grumbled. "That flighting was the last straw. He must be imprisoned and punished." "Annette," Kvasir announced.
Frey scowled.
"What do you mean?"
"See? Loki was burning the evidence."
Kvasir traced a barely discernible pattern of crossed lines in the ashes.
"He was trying to anticipate our moves, considering all the ways we might capture him. He wove a net, then quickly burned it."
Kvasir rose.
"Gentlemen, Loki has disguised himself as a fish. We need a net."
The others looked amazed. Like, "Holmes, how did you do that?" I waited for Kvasir to cry, "The game's afoot." Instead, he shouted,
"To the nearest river!"
and strode off, the other gods hurrying after him. My dream changed. I saw flashes of Kvasir's life as he traveled the nine worlds, advising the locals on everything from farming to childbirth to tax deductions. All mortal beings loved him. In every town, castle, and village, he was greeted like a hero. Then one day, after filling out some particularly difficult tax forms for a family of giants, he was on the road to Midgard when he was stopped by a pair of dwarves, stunted, warty, hairy little guys with malicious smiles. Unfortunately, I recognized them, the brothers Fjallar and Gialar. They'd once sold me a one-way boat ride. According to Blitzen, they were also notorious thieves and murderers.
"Hello!"
Fjallar called to Kvasir from the top of a boulder.
You must be the famous Kvasir!
Next to him, Gyalar waved enthusiastically.
Well met! We've heard wonderful things about you.
Kvasir, being the wisest being ever created, should have known enough to say, sorry, I gave it the office, and keep walking. Unfortunately, Kvasir was also kind. He raised his hand in greeting.
Hello, good dwarves. I am indeed Kvasir. How may I help you?
Fialar and Gyalar exchanged glances, like they couldn't believe their good luck.
Well, you can be our guest for dinner.
Gyalar gestured to a nearby hillside, where the entrance to a cave was covered with curtains of ragged leather.
We are not interested in murdering you, Fialar promised, or stealing your stuff, or draining your blood, which probably has incredible magical properties. We simply want to show you our hospitality.
Much appreciated, Kvasir said. But I am expected in Midgard tonight. Many humans need my help.
Oh, I see, Fialar said. You like helping people.
He said it the way one might say, you like raw beef.
Well, as it happens, we're having a terrible time with our, quarterly estimated taxes.
Kvasir frowned in sympathy.
I see. Those can be difficult to calculate.
Yes, Gyalar clasped his hands. Could you help us, oh wise one?
This was like the part in every horror movie when the audience yells, don't do it! But Kvasir's compassion overcame his wisdom.
Very well, he said. Show me your paperwork.
He followed the dwarves into their cave. I wanted to run after him, to warn him what was going to happen, but my feet remained rooted to the ground. Inside the cave, Kvasir began to scream. A few moments later, I heard a sound like a chainsaw, then liquid gurgling into a large cauldron. If I'd been able to throw up in my sleep, I would have. The scene shifted one last time. I found myself in the front yard of a 3-story mansion, one in a line of colonials facing a public green. It might have been Salem or Lexington, one of those sleepy pre-revolutionary towns outside Boston. White-painted columns flanked the house's entrance. Honeysuckle bushes filled the air with sugary perfume. An American flag fluttered on the porch. The scene was so bucolic it could have been Alfheim if the sunlight had been a little harsher. The front door swung open, and a skinny figure tumbled down the brick steps as if she'd been thrown. Alex Fierro looked about 14, maybe 2 or 3 years younger than when I'd met her. A trickle of blood ran from her left temple. She crawled down the front walk on her hands and knees, her palms shredded from breaking her fall and leaving dabs of blood across the cement like a sponge painting. She didn't look scared so much as bitter and angry, with tears of frustration in her eyes. In the doorway of the house, a middle-aged man appeared. Short, dark hair streaked with gray, pressed black slacks, shiny black shoes, a white dress shirt so crisp and bright it hurt my eyes. I could imagine Blitzen saying, you really need a splash of color, sir. The man had Alex's petite build. His face was handsome in the same harsh, angular way, like a diamond you could admire, but not touch without getting cut. He shouldn't have been scary. He wasn't big or strong or tough-looking. He dressed like a banker. But there was something terrifying about the set of his jaw, the intensity of his stare, the way his lips twitched and tightened across his teeth, as if he hadn't quite mastered human expressions. I wanted to put myself between him and Alex, but I couldn't move. In one hand, the man hefted a ceramic object the size of a football, a brown and white ovoid.
I saw that it was a bust with two different faces side by side.
Normal!
The man threw the ceramic sculpture at Alex. It shattered on the walkway.
That's all I want from you. To be a normal kid. Is that so damn hard?
Alex struggled to her feet. She turned to face her father. A mauve skirt hung to her knees over black leggings. Her green sleeveless top had given her arms no protection from the pavement. Her elbows looked like they'd been struck by a meat tenderizer. Her hair was longer than I'd ever seen it, a green ponytail sprouting from her black roots like a flame from Aegir's hearth fire.
I am normal, father!
She hissed the word as if it was the most twisted insult she could think of.
No more help.
His tone was hard and cold.
No more money.
I don't want your money.
Well, that's good, because it's going to my real children.
He spat on the steps.
You had so much potential. You understood the craft almost as well as your grandfather. And look at you.
The art, Alex corrected.
What?
It's art, not craft. Her father waved in disgust at the broken ceramic pieces.
That is not art. It's trash.
The sentiment was clear, even if he didn't say it. You have chosen to be trash, too. Alex glared at her father. The air between them turned dry and bitter. Both seemed to be waiting for the other to make a definitive gesture, to apologize and give in, or to cut the thread between them forever. Alex got no such resolution. Her father shook his head in dismay, as if he couldn't believe his life had come to this. Then he turned and went inside, slamming the door behind him. I woke with a start.
What?
Relax, sleepy. Alex Fierro stood over me. Today's Alex, wearing a raincoat of such bright yellow, I wondered if our ship had begun to assimilate her. The banging sound I'd heard in my dream had been her dropping a full canteen next to my head. She lobbed an apple at my chest.
Breakfast, she said, and also lunch.
I rubbed my eyes. I could still hear the voice of her father and smell the honeysuckle in their front yard. How long was I out?
About 16 hours, she said. You didn't miss much, so we let you sleep. But now it's time.
For what? I sat up in my sleeping bag. My friends moved around the deck, tying off lines and securing the oars. Cold drizzle hung in the air. Our longship was moored at a stone embankment, on a river lined with brick townhouses not too different than those back home in Boston.
Welcome to Jorvik, Halfborn glowered. Or as you modern folk call it, York, England.
Chapter 17. We are ambushed by a pile of rocks. In case you're wondering, Old York looks absolutely nothing like New York. It looks older. Magnus Chase, Master of Description. You're welcome. Halfborn wasn't thrilled to be back at his old base camp.
No self-respecting Viking city should be so far from the sea, he grumbled. I don't know why Ivar the Boneless even bothered with this place. We wasted all morning sailing here. About 25 miles up the River Ouse.
The River Ouse? I asked. Ouse, TJ corrected, breaking into a grin. It rhymes with moose. I read about it in a travel guide. I shuddered. Nothing good rhymes with moose. Excuse, noose, caboose. I also found it disturbing that TJ had done so much research on England. Then again, 150 years is a long time to hang around Valhalla, and the hotel library is impressive. I glanced over the port side. Murky green water curled and swelled around our hull. the rain stippling the surface of the river with overlapping bullseyes. The current seemed too alive, too awake. No matter how much Percy Jackson had trained me, I did not want to fall in there.
You sense them, don't you?
Halfborn gripped his axe as if ready to cut loose on the ooze.
The Vatn of Atir.
Halfborn said the word as if he found it truly awful, like cowardice or beard trimmer. What are they? I asked. And do they have a more pronounceable name? Alex added.
They're nature spirits, Mallory said. We have similar legends in Ireland. We call them Ach Ishka, water horses.
Halfborn snorted.
You Irish have similar legends because you got them from the Norse.
Lies,
Mallory growled.
The Celts were in Ireland long before you louts invaded.
Louts? The Viking kingdom of Dublin was the only power worth mentioning on your miserable island.
Anyway,
Samira stepped between the two lovebirds.
Why are these water horses dangerous?
Halfborn frowned.
Well, they can form a herd, and if they get riled up, stampede and destroy our ship. I imagine they've only held off this long because they're not sure what to make of us being bright yellow. Also, if anyone is foolish enough to touch them,
they'll adhere to your skin, Mallory said. Drag you under and drown you.
Her words made my stomach clench. I'd once gotten myself adhered to a magical eagle that proceeded to take me on a demolition derby tour over the rooftops of Boston. The idea of being dragged into the ooze sounded even less fun. Alex threw her arms around Mallory and Halfborn.
Well then, it sounds like you two are the water horse experts. You should stay on board and defend the big banana while the rest of us go giant hunting.
I said. I can just turn the ship into a handkerchief.
Oh no, Halfborn said. I have no desire to set foot in Jorvik again. I wouldn't be of any use to you anyway. Place has changed a bit in 1,200 years. I'll stay on the ship, but I don't need Mallory's help defending it.
You think not?
Mallory glared up at him, her hands on the hilts of her knives.
Do you know any Gaelic songs for calming the water horses? I'm not leaving this ship in your care.
Well, I'm not leaving it in your care.
Guys!
Samira raised her hands like a boxing referee. She'd never been much of a curser, but I got the sense she was struggling with the Ramadan no-cursing rule again. Funny how that works. As soon as you're told you can't do something, you have the overwhelming desire to do it.
If you both insist on staying aboard, she said, I'll stay too. I'm good with horses. I can fly if I get in trouble. And in a pinch,
she flicked her wrist, telescoping her spear of light into existence,
I can blast anything that attacks us. Or I can blast the two of you if you don't behave.
Halfborn and Mallory looked equally unhappy about that arrangement, which meant it was a good compromise.
You heard the lady, Alex said. The landing party will consist of me, TJ, and blonde guy.
Excellent, TJ rubbed his hands. I can't wait to thank the British. TJ wasn't kidding. As we walked the narrow streets of York in a cold gray drizzle, he greeted everyone he saw and tried to shake hands.
Hello, he said. I'm from Boston. Thank you for not supporting the Confederacy.
The reactions of the locals ranged from, eh, to leave off, to some phrases so colorful I wondered if the speakers had descended from Halfborn Gunderson. TJ wasn't deterred. He strolled along, waving and pointing.
Anything you guys need, he offered. I owe you.
He grinned at me.
I love this place. The people are so friendly.
Uh-huh. I scanned the low rooftops, figuring that if there was a giant in this city, I should be able to spot him. So, if you were a Jotun in York, where would you be hiding? Alex stopped in front of a collection of street signs. With her green hair sticking out the hood of her yellow raincoat, she looked like a punk spokesperson for frozen fish sticks. Maybe we could start there. She pointed at the top sign. The Jorvik Viking Center. It sounded like as good a plan as any, especially since we had no other plans. We followed the signs, winding our way through narrow, crooked streets lined with brick townhouses, pubs, and storefronts. It could have been the north end of Boston, except York was even more of a historical patchwork. Victorian brick butted up against medieval stone, which butted up against black-and-white Elizabethan magpie, which butted up against a tanning salon offering 20 minutes for £5. We passed only a few people. Traffic was light. I wondered if it was a holiday, or if the locals had heard about the bright yellow Viking ship invading the Ouse and had run for the hills. I decided it was just as well. If there had been more English folk to meet and greet, TJ would have really slowed us down. We made our way down a street called The Shambles, which struck me as an honest description, but poor branding. The road itself was just wide enough for a bicycle, assuming the rider was skinny. The houses overhung the sidewalk at funhouse mirror angles, each story a little wider than the one below it, giving the impression that the entire neighborhood would collapse in on itself if we took one wrong step. I barely breathed until we emerged onto a wider avenue. Finally, the signs led us to a pedestrian shopping area, where a squat brick building was festooned with green banners. Vikings! Living history! Thrills! Full interactive experience! All of which sounded pretty good. Except for the sign across the front entrance. Closed. Huh. TJ rattled the door handle. Should we break in? I didn't see what good that would do. The place was obviously a museum for tourists. No matter how good this interactive experience was, it would be a letdown after actually living in Valhalla. I didn't need any Viking paraphernalia from the gift shop either. My runestone pendant, talking sword, was as much as I could handle. Guys? Alex said, her voice tight. Did that wall just move? I followed her gaze. Across the pedestrian plaza, jutting from the side of a Tesco Express grocery store, was a crumbling section of rough-hewn limestone blocks that might have been part of a castle or the old city walls. At least that's what I thought. Until the pile of limestone shifted. A few times, I had watched Samira emerge from beneath her camouflage hijab. It would look like she had stepped out of a tree trunk, or a plain white wall, or the display case at a Dunkin' Donuts. This sight gave me a similar kind of vertigo. My mind had to reprocess what I was looking at. Not a section of ruined wall, but a giant 20 feet tall, whose appearance perfectly mimicked limestone. His rough brown and beige skin was beaded like a Gila monster's. A flocking of rubble crusted his long, shaggy hair and beard. He wore a tunic and leggings of quilted heavy canvas, giving him that fortress wall look. Why he'd been leaning against the grocery store, I had no idea. Dozing? Panhandling? Did giants panhandle? He fixed us with his amber eyes, the only part of him that seemed truly alive.
Well, well, rumbled the giant. I've been waiting ages for Vikings to appear at the Viking Center. Can't wait to kill you.
Good idea, Alex, I squeaked. Let's follow the signs to the Viking Center. Yay. For once, she had no scathing comeback. She stared at the giant, her mouth hanging open, her raincoat hood slipping back from her head. TJ's rifle quivered in his hands like a dowsing rod. I didn't feel much braver. Sure, I'd seen taller giants, I'd seen eagle giants, fire giants, drunk giants, and giants in gaudy bowling shirts. But I'd never had a stone giant appear right in front of me and cheerfully offer to kill me. Standing upright, his shoulders were level with the two-story rooftops around us. The few pedestrians on the streets simply walked around him as if he were an inconvenient construction project. He grabbed the nearest telephone pole and yanked it out of the ground along with a large circular chunk of pavement. Only when he rested the pole across his shoulder did I realize it was his weapon. A maul with a head the size of a hot tub.
"Vikings used to be more social," he rumbled. "I thought surely they'd come to their community center for trials by combat. Or at least for bingo. But you're the first ones I've seen in..."
He tilted his shaggy head, a gesture that looked like an avalanche of sheepdogs.
"How long was I sitting there? I must have dozed off. Ah, well. Tell me your names, warriors. I would like to know who I am killing."
At that point, I would have screamed, "I claim guest rights." But sadly, we were not inside the giant's home. I doubted guest rights would apply on a public street in a human city.
"Are you the giant Hrungnir?"
I asked, hoping I sounded more confident than panic-stricken.
"I'm Magnus Chase. This is Thomas Jefferson Jr. and Alex Fierro. We're here to bargain with you."
The shaggy stone colossus looked from side to side.
"Of course I am Hrungnir. Do you see any other giants around? I'm afraid killing you is non-negotiable, little Inherye, but we can haggle about the details if you like."
I gulped.
"How did you know we're Inherjar?"
Hrungnir grinned, his teeth like the crenellations of a castle turret.
"You smell like Inherjar. Now come. What were you hoping to bargain for? A quick death? A death by squeezing? Perhaps a lovely death by stomping, followed by being scraped off the bottom of my shoe?"
I glanced at TJ, who shook his head vigorously like, "Not the shoe." Alex still hadn't moved. I only knew she was still alive because she blinked the rain out of her eyes.
"Oh, large and beige Hrungnir," I said. "We seek the location of Kvasir's mead."
Hrungnir scowled, his rocky eyebrows furrowing, his brick-like lips forming a segmental arch.
"Well, well. Playing Odin's thievery game, are you? The old bulwark trick?"
Maybe.
Hrungnir chuckled.
"I could give you that information. I was with Bogi and Suttung when they sequestered the mead in its new hiding place."
"Right,"
I silently added Bogi and Suttung to my mental list of things I am clueless about.
"That's what we have come to bargain for. The location of the mead."
I realized I had already said that.
"What is your price, O beige one?"
Hrungnir stroked his beard, causing rubble and dust to sift down the front of his tunic.
"For me to consider such a trade, your deaths would have to be very entertaining."
He studied TJ, then me. His eyes came to rest on Alex Fierro.
"Ah, this one smells of clay. You have the necessary skills, do you not?"
I glanced at Alex. "Necessary skills?"
"Eep,"
Alex said.
"Excellent," Hrungnir boomed. "It's been centuries since the stone giants found a worthy opponent for a traditional two-on-two duel. A fight to the death. Shall we say tomorrow at dawn?"
"Whoa," I said. "Couldn't we do a healing contest?"
"Or bingo," TJ offered. "Bingo is good."
"No!"
No! Hrungnir cried. My very name means brawler, little Enheri. You won't cheat me out of a good fight. We will follow the ancient rules of combat. Me versus...
I didn't want to volunteer, but I'd seen Jack take down bigger giants than this guy before. I raised my hand. Very well.
No, you're too scrawny.
Hrungnir pointed to TJ.
I challenge him.
I accept, TJ yelled. Then he blinked as if thinking, thanks a lot, Dad.
Good, good, the giant said. And my second will fight your second, who will be made by her.
Alex staggered back as if she'd been pushed. I can't. I've never...
Or I can just kill all three of you now, Hrungnir said. Then you'll have no chance of finding Kvasir's mead.
My mouth felt as dusty as the giant's beard. Alex, what's he talking about? What are you supposed to make? By the trapped look in her eyes, I could tell she understood Hrungnir's demand. I'd only seen her this panicked once before, on her first day in Valhalla, when she thought she might be stuck in one gender for the rest of eternity. She licked her lips. All right. I'll do it.
That's the spirit, Hrungnir said. As for the little blonde guy here, I guess he can be your water boy or something. Well, I'm off to make my second. You should do the same. I will meet you tomorrow at dawn at Konungsgirtha.
The giant turned and strode through the streets of York, pedestrians moving out of his way as if he were a veering bus. I turned to Alex. Explain? What did you just agree to? The contrast between her heterochromatic eyes seemed even greater than usual, as if the gold and the brown were separating, pooling to the left and right. We need to find a pottery studio, she said. Fast. Chapter 18. I roll Play-Doh to the death. You don't hear heroes say that a lot. Quick, boy wonder, to the pottery studio. But Alex's tone left no doubt it was a matter of life and death. The nearest ceramics workshop, a place called the Earthery, turned out to be on my favorite street, the Shambles. I didn't see that as a good omen. While TJ and I waited outside, Alex spent a few minutes talking with the proprietor, who at last emerged, grinning and holding a large wad of multicolored money. Have fun, lads! He said as he hurried down the street. Brilliant! Ta! Thank you, TJ waved. And thanks for not getting involved in our civil war! We headed inside, where Alex was taking inventory. Work tables, potter's wheels, metal shelves lined with half-finished pots, tubs filled with tools, a cabinet stacked with slabs of wet clay in plastic bags. In the back of the studio, one door led to a small bathroom, another to what looked like a storage room. This might work, Alex muttered. Maybe. Did you buy this place? I asked. Don't be silly. I just paid the owner for 24 hours exclusive use. But I paid well. In British pounds, I noted. Where'd you get so much local cash? She shrugged, her attention on counting bags of clay. It's called preparation, Chase. I figured we'd be traveling to the UK and Scandinavia. I brought euros, kronor, kroner, and pounds. Compliments of my family. And by compliments, I mean I stole it. I remembered my dream of Alex in front of her house, the way she'd snarled, I don't want your money. Maybe she'd meant she only wanted it on her terms. I could respect that. But how she'd gotten so many different currencies, I couldn't guess. Stop gopping and help me, she ordered.
I wasn't gopping.
We need to push these tables together, she said. TJ, go see if there's more clay in the back. We need a lot more.
On it.
TJ dashed to the supply room. Alex and I moved four tables together, making a work surface big enough to play ping pong on. TJ hauled out extra bags of clay until I estimated we had an adequate amount to make a ceramic Volkswagen. Alex looked back and forth between the clay and the potter's wheels. She tapped her thumbnail nervously against her teeth. Not enough time, she muttered. Drying, glazing, firing. Alex, I said, if you want us to help you, you're going to have to explain what we're doing. TJ edged away from me, in case Alex brought out the garrote. She just glared at me.
You would know what I'm doing if you'd taken Pottery 101 in Valhalla with me like I asked you.
I had a scheduling conflict.
In fact, I hadn't liked the idea of pottery to the death, especially if it involved getting thrown in a fiery kiln.
Stone giants have a tradition called Tvervigi, said Alex. Double combat.
It's like Viking single combat. Einvigi, TJ added. Except Tver instead of Ein.
Fascinating, I said.
I know. I read about it in... Please don't say a travel guide.
TJ looked at the floor. Alex picked up a box of assorted wooden tools.
Honestly, Chase, we don't have time to bring you up to speed. TJ fights Hrungnir. I make a ceramic warrior who fights the giant's ceramic warrior. You play water boy, or heel, or whatever. It's pretty straightforward.
I stared at the bags of clay. A ceramic warrior? As in magic pottery?
Pottery 101, Alex repeated, like that was obvious. TJ, would you start cutting those slabs? I need slices 1 inch thick, about 60 or 70 of them.
Sure. Do I get to use your garrote?
Alex laughed long and hard.
Absolutely not. There should be a cutter in that gray tub.
TJ sulked off to find a regular clay cutter.
And you, Alex told me, you're going to be making coils.
Coils.
I know you can roll clay into coils. It's just like making snakes out of Play-Doh.
I wondered how she knew my dark secret, that I had enjoyed Play-Doh as a kid. And when I say kid, I mean up to like age 11. I grudgingly admitted that this was within my scope of talents.
And you?
The hardest part is using the wheel, she said. The most important components have to be thrown.
By thrown, I knew she meant shaped on the wheel, not thrown across the room. Though with Alex, the two activities often went together.
All right, boys, she said. Let's get to work.
After a few hours spent rolling coils, my shoulders ached. My shirt stuck to my sweaty skin. When I closed my eyes, clay snakes flopped around on the backs of my eyelids. My only relief was getting up to change the station on the proprietor's little radio whenever Alex or TJ didn't like a song. TJ preferred martial music, but English radio had a shocking lack of marching band tunes. Alex favored songs from Japanese anime, also in short supply on the AM/FM dial. Finally, they both settled on Duran Duran, for reasons I can't explain. From time to time, I brought Alex soft drinks from the proprietor's mini-fridge. Her favorite was Tizer, a sort of cherry soda with extra twang. I didn't like it, but Alex quickly got addicted. Her lips turned bright red like a vampire's, which I found both disturbing and strangely fascinating. Meanwhile, TJ ran back and forth between his slab cutting and the kiln, which was heating up for an epic day of firing. He seemed to take special pleasure in poking pencil stub-sized dents in the slabs so they wouldn't crack when baked. He did this while humming Hungry Like the Wolf. Not my favorite song, given my personal history. TJ seemed cheerful for a guy who had a duel scheduled with a 20-foot-tall stone giant in the morning. I decided not to remind him that if he died here in England, he would stay dead, no matter how friendly the locals were. I had placed my work table as close as I could to Alex's wheel so I could talk to her. Usually, I waited to ask her a question until she was centering a new lump of clay. With both her hands engaged, she was less likely to hit me. "Have you done this before?" I asked. "Made a pottery guy?" She glanced over, her face flecked with white porcelain. "Tried a few times. Nothing this big. But my family..." She bore down on the clay, molding it into a beehive-like cone. "Like Hrungnir said, we have the necessary skills." "Your family?" I tried to imagine Loki sitting at a table, rolling clay snakes. "The Fieros." Alex shot me a wary look. "You really don't know? Never heard of Fiero ceramics?"
Should I have?"
She smiled, as if she found my ignorance refreshing. "If you knew anything about cooking or home decor, maybe. It was a hot brand about 10 years ago. But that's fine. I'm not talking about the machine-made crap my dad sells anyway. I'm talking about my grandfather's art. He started the business when he emigrated from Tlatilco." "Tlatilco." I tried to place the name. "I'm guessing that's outside I-95? Alex laughed. "No reason you'd have heard of it. Tiny place in Mexico. These days, it's really just a subsection of Mexico City. According to my grandfather, our family has been making pottery there since before the Aztecs. Tlatilco used to be this super ancient culture." She pressed her thumbs into the center of her beehive, opening up the sides of the new pot. It still seemed like magic to me the way she did it, shaping such a delicate and perfectly symmetrical vase with nothing but strength and spin. The few times I'd tried to use a wheel, I'd nearly broken my fingers and managed to turn a lump of clay into a slightly uglier lump of clay. "Who knows what's true?" Alex continued. "These are just family stories, legends. But my abuelo took them seriously. When he moved to Boston, he kept doing things the old way. Even if he was just making a plate or a cup, he'd create every piece by hand, with lots of pride and attention to detail."
"Blitzen would like that."
Alex sat back, regarding her pot.
"Yeah, my granddad would have made a good dwarf.
Then my dad took over the business and decided to go commercial. He sold out. He mass-produced lines of ceramic dishware, entered into deals with home furnishing supply chains. He made millions before people started realizing the quality was going downhill." I recalled her father's bitter words in my dream. "You had so much potential. You understood the craft almost as well as your grandfather. He wanted you to carry on the family business." She studied me, no doubt wondering how I'd guessed. I almost told her about the dream. But Alex really did not like having people inside her head, even unintentionally. And I didn't like being yelled at.
"My father is an idiot," she said. "He didn't understand how I could like pottery but not want to make money off it. He definitely didn't appreciate me listening to my granddad's crazy ideas."
"Such as?"
Over at his work table, TJ kept poking holes in the clay slices with a dowel, creating different patterns, like stars and spirals.
"This is kind of fun," he admitted.
"Therapeutic." Alex's Tizer red lips curled up at the edges. "My abuelo made pottery for a living, but his real interest was in our ancestors' sculptures. He wanted to understand the spirituality of them." That wasn't easy. I mean, after so many centuries, trying to figure out your heritage when it's been buried under so much else. Olmec, Aztec, Spanish, Mexican. How do you even know what's true?
How do you reclaim it? I got the feeling her questions were rhetorical and didn't require answers from me, which was just as well. I couldn't think clearly with TJ humming Rio and dowling smiley faces in his clay. But your granddad managed, I guessed. He thought so. Alex spun up the wheel again, sponging the sides of her pot. So did I. My dad. Her expression soured. Well, he liked to blame, you know, the way I am, on Loki. He didn't like it at all when I found validation on the Fiero side of the family. My brain felt like my hands, as if a layer of clay was tightening over it, sucking out all the moisture. Sorry, I don't understand. What does this have to do with magic ceramic warriors? You'll see. Fish the phone out of my pocket and call Sam, will you? Give her an update. Then shut up so I can concentrate. Even under orders, pulling something out of Alex's pants pocket while she was wearing said pants seemed like a good way to get myself killed. I managed, with only a couple of small panic attacks, and found that Alex's phone had data service in the UK. She must have arranged that when she arranged her multi-currency theft. I texted Samira and gave her the lowdown. A few minutes later, the phone buzzed with her reply. K. GL. Fighting. GTG. I wondered if GTG in this context meant got to go, Gunderson throttling girlfriend, or giants torturing Gunderson. I decided to think optimistically and went with the first option. As the afternoon wore on, the back tables filled up with fired porcelain squares that looked like armored plates. Alex taught me how, by combining my coils, to form cylinders that would serve as arms and legs. Her efforts at the pottery wheel produced feet, hands, and a head, all shaped like vases and meticulously decorated with Viking runes. She spent hours on the faces, two of them, side by side, like the piece of art that Alex's father had shattered in my dream. The left face had heavy-lidded, suspicious eyes, a cartoon villain's curly mustache, and a huge, grimacing mouth. The right face was a grinning skull with hollow eye holes and a lolling tongue. Looking at the two visages pressed together, I couldn't help thinking about Alex's own different colored eyes. By evening, we'd laid out all the pieces of the ceramic warrior on our quadruple table, creating an 8-foot-long Frankenstein's monster. Some assembly required. Well, TJ wiped his forehead. That thing would scare me if I had to face it in battle. Agreed, I said. And speaking of faces, it's a duality mask, Alex explained. My ancestors from Tlatilco. They made a lot of the figurines with two faces, or one face with two halves. Nobody's sure why. My grandfather thought they represented two spirits in a single body.
Like my old Lenape friend Mother William, TJ said. So I guess the native cultures down in Mexico had Augur too.
He corrected himself quickly. I mean trans folks, gender-fluid folks. Augur, the Viking word for someone of shifting gender, literally meant unmanly, which was not an Alex-approved term. I studied the mask. No wonder the duality art spoke to you. Your granddad, he got who you were.
He got it,
Alex agreed.
And he honored it. When he died, my dad did his best to discredit my abuelo's ideas, destroy his art, and turn me into a good little business person. I wouldn't let him.
She rubbed the nape of her neck, maybe subconsciously touching the tattooed symbol of the figure-eight serpents. She had embraced shapeshifting, refusing to let Loki ruin it for her. She had done the same with pottery, even though her father had turned the family business into something she despised. Alex, I said, the more I find out about you, the more I admire you. Her expression was a mix of amusement and exasperation, like I was a cute puppy that had just peed on the carpet. Hold the admiration until I can bring this thing to life, smooth talker. That's the real trick. In the meantime, we all need some fresh air. She threw me another wad of money. Let's go get some dinner. You're buying. Chapter 19. I attend a zombie pep rally. Dinner was fish and chips at a place called Mr. Chippy. TJ found the name hilarious. While we ate, he kept saying, "Mr. Chippy," in a loud, bubbly voice, which did not amuse the guy at the register. Afterward, we returned to the pottery studio to lay low for the night. TJ suggested going back to the ship to be with the rest of the crew, but Alex insisted she needed to keep an eye on her ceramic warrior. She texted Sam an update. Sam's response? NP. Okay, here. Fighting water horses. Fighting water horses was written in emojis. Fist, wave, horse. I guessed Sam had fought so many of them today she'd decided to make a text shortcut. You got her international coverage too, I noted. Well, yeah, Alex said. Gotta keep in touch with my sister. I wanted to ask why she hadn't done the same for me. Then I remembered I didn't have a phone. Most in Harryar didn't bother with them. For one thing, getting a number and paying the bill is hard when you're officially dead. Also, no data plan covers the rest of the nine worlds. And the reception in Valhalla is horrible. I blame the roof of Golden Shields. Despite all that, Alex insisted on keeping a phone. How she managed, I didn't know. Maybe Samira had registered her in some kind of friends and family, and also dead family program. As soon as we reached the studio, Alex checked on her ceramic project. I wasn't sure whether to be relieved or disappointed that it hadn't assembled itself and come to life yet. "I'll check it again in a few hours," she said. "Gonna..." She staggered to the only comfy chair in the room, the proprietor's clay-spattered Barca lounger, then passed out and began to snore. Yikes, she could snore. TJ and I decided to bunk in the storage room, where we'd be better insulated from Alex's impression of a dying lawnmower. We made some impromptu mattresses out of canvas tarps. TJ cleaned his rifle and sharpened his bayonet, a nighttime ritual for him. I lay down and watched the rain patter against the skylights. The glass leaked, dripping on the metal shelves and filling the room with the smell of damp rust, but I didn't mind. I was grateful for the steady drumming. "So, what happens tomorrow?" I asked TJ. "I mean, exactly." TJ laughed. "Exactly. I fight a 20-foot-tall giant until one of us dies or can't fight anymore. Meanwhile, the giant's clay warrior fights Alex's clay warrior until one of them is rubble. Alex, I don't know, cheers on her creation, I guess. You heal me if you can." "That's allowed?" TJ shrugged. "Far as I know, anything's allowed for you and Alex as long as you don't actually fight. Doesn't it bother you that your opponent is 15 feet taller than you?" TJ straightened his back. "Do you think I look that short? I'm almost 6 feet. How can you be so calm?" He inspected the edge of his bayonet, holding it up to his face so it seemed to cut him in half like a duality mask. "I've already beat the odds so many times, Magnus. On James Island, South Carolina, I was standing right next to a friend of mine, Joe Wilson, when a Reb sniper..." He made a finger gun and pulled the trigger. "Could have been me. Could have been any of us. I hit the dirt, rolled over, and stared up at the sky, and this sense of calm washed over me. I wasn't afraid anymore." "Yeah, that's called shock." He shook his head. "Nah, I saw Valkyries, Magnus. Ladies on horses
swirling in the skies above our regiment. I finally believed what my ma had always told me about my dad being Tyr. Those crazy stories about Norse gods in Boston. Right then I decided, okay, what happens, happens. If my dad is the god of bravery, I'd better make him proud. I wasn't sure that would have been my reaction. I was glad I had a father who was proud of me for healing people, enjoying the outdoors, and tolerating his talking sword. You've met your dad? I asked. He gave you that bayonet, right? TJ folded the blade in his chamois cloth like he was tucking it into bed. The bayonet was waiting for me when I checked into Valhalla. I never met Tyr face to face. TJ shrugged. Still, every time I accept a challenge, I feel closer to him. The more dangerous, the better. You must feel super close to him right now, I guessed. TJ grinned. Yep. Good times. I wondered how a god could go 150 years without acknowledging a son as brave as TJ, but my friend wasn't alone. I knew a lot of Inheriar who had never met their parents. FaceTime with the kids wasn't a priority for Norse deities, maybe because they had hundreds or thousands of children, or maybe because the gods were jerks. TJ lay back on his tarp mattress. Now I just gotta figure out how to kill that giant. I'm worried a direct frontal charge might not work. For a Civil War soldier, this was creative thinking. So what's your plan? I asked. No idea. He tipped his Union cap over his eyes. Maybe something will come to me in my dreams. Night, Magnus. He began to snore almost as loudly as Alex. I couldn't win. I lay awake, wondering how Sam, Halfborn, and Mallory were doing on board the ship. I wondered why Blitzen and Hearthstone weren't back yet, and why it would take them 5 days just to scout the location of a whetstone. Niord had promised I'd see them again before the really dangerous stuff went down. I should have gotten him to swear an oath on his immaculately groomed feet. Mainly, though, I worried about my own impending duel with Loki. A contest of insults with the most eloquent Norse deity. What had I been thinking? No matter how magical Kvasir's mead was, how could it possibly help me beat Loki at his own game? No pressure, of course. If I lost, I'd just be reduced to a shadow of myself and imprisoned in Helheim while all my friends died and Ragnarok destroyed the Nine Worlds. Maybe I could buy a book of Viking insults at the Viking Center gift shop. TJ snored on. I admired his courage and positivity. I wondered if I'd have a tenth of his presence of mind when I had to face Loki. My conscience answered, "No!" then broke down in hysterical sobbing. Thanks to the rain, I finally managed to sleep. But my dreams were not relaxing, nor were they reassuring. I found myself back on Naglfar, the ship of the dead. Masses of draugr swarmed the deck, rags and mildewed armor hanging from their bodies, their spears and swords corroded like burnt matchsticks. The warriors' spirits fluttered inside their ribcages, like blue flames clinging to the last remnants of kindling. Thousands upon thousands shambled toward the foredeck, where hand-painted banners hung along the rails and waved from the yardarms in the frigid wind. Make some noise! Go, draugr, go! Ragnarok and roll! And other slogans so terrible they could only have been written by the dishonored dead. I did not see Loki, but standing at the helm, on a dais cobbled together from dead men's nails, was a giant so old I almost thought he might be one of the undead. I'd never seen him before, but I'd heard stories about him. Hrym, the captain of the ship. His very name meant decrepit. His bare arms were painfully emaciated. Wisps of white hair clung to his leathery head like icicles, making me think of pictures I'd seen of prehistoric men found in melting glaciers. Moldy white furs covered his wasted frame. His pale blue eyes, though, were very much alive.
He couldn't have been as frail as he looked. In one hand, he brandished a battle axe bigger than I was. In the other hand was a shield made from the sternum of some huge animal, the space between the ribs fitted with sheets of studded iron.
"Soldiers of Helheim," the giant bellowed. "Behold!"
He gestured across the gray water. At the other end of the bay, the glacial cliffs crumbled more rapidly, ice cracking and sloughing into the sea with a sound like distant artillery.
"The way will soon be clear,"
the giant shouted.
"Then we sail to battle. Death to the gods!"
The cry went up all around me, hollow, hateful voices of the long dead taking up the chant. Mercifully, my dream shifted. I stood in a recently plowed wheat field on a warm, sunny day. In the distance, wildflowers blanketed rolling hills. Beyond that, milk-white waterfalls tumbled down the sides of picturesque mountains. Some part of my brain thought, "At last, a pleasant dream. I'm in a commercial for organic whole wheat bread." Then an old man in blue robes hobbled toward me. His clothes were tattered and mud-stained from long travel. His wide-brimmed hat shaded his face, though I could make out his graying beard and secretive smile. When he reached me, he looked up, revealing one eye that gleamed with malicious humor. The other eye socket was dark and empty.
"I am Bolverk," he said, though of course I knew it was Odin. Aside from his less than creative disguise, once you've heard Odin give a keynote address on best berserker practices, you never forget his voice. "I'm here to make you the deal of a lifetime."
From beneath his cloak, he produced an object the size of a cheese round, covered in cloth. I was afraid it might be one of Odin's inspirational CD collections. Then he unwrapped it, revealing a circular whetstone of gray quartz. It reminded me of the bashing end of Hrungnir's maul, only smaller and less maul-worthy. Odin Bolverk offered it to me.
"Will you pay the price?"
Suddenly, Odin was gone. Before me loomed a face so large I couldn't take it all in. Glowing green eyes with vertical slits for pupils, leathery nostrils dripping with mucus. The stench of acid and rotten meat burned my lungs. The creature's maw opened to reveal rows of jagged triangular teeth ready to shred me, and I sat bolt upright, screaming in my bed of tarps. Above me, dim gray light filtered through the skylights. The rain had stopped. TJ sat across from me, munching a bagel, a strange pair of glasses on his face. Each lens had a clear center, bordered by a ring of amber glass, making TJ look like he'd acquired a second set of irises.
"Finally up," he noted. "Bad dreams, huh?"
My whole body felt jittery, like coins rattling inside a change separator machine.
What's going on?" I asked. "What's with the glasses?"
Alex Fierro appeared in the doorway.
"A scream that high could only be Magnus." "Ah, good. You're awake."
She tossed me a brown paper bag that smelled of garlic.
"Come on, time's wasting."
She led us to the main room, where her ceramic duality dude still lay in pieces. She circled the table, checking her work and nodding with satisfaction, though I couldn't see that anything had changed.
"Okay, yep, we're good."
I opened the paper bag and frowned.
"You left me a garlic bagel?"
"Last awake, last choice," Alex said.
"My breath is going to be terrible."
"More terrible," Alex corrected. "Well, that's fine. I'm not kissing you. Are you kissing him, TJ?"
"Wasn't planning on it."
TJ popped the last of his bagel in his mouth and grinned.
I didn't say anything about," I stammered.
I didn't mean... My face felt like it was crawling with fire ants. Whatever. TJ, why are you wearing those glasses anyway? I'm good at subtly changing the conversation like that when I'm embarrassed. It's a gift. TJ wiggled his new specs.
You helped jog my memory, Magnus, talking about that sniper last night. Then I dreamed about Hrungnir and those weird amber eyes of his, and I saw myself laughing and shooting him dead. Then when I woke up, I remembered I had these in my haversack. Completely forgot about them. It sounded like TJ had way better dreams than I did, which was no surprise.
They're sniper glasses, he explained. They're what we used before scopes were invented. I bought this pair in Valhalla, 100 years ago, I guess, so I'm pretty sure they're magic. Can't wait to try them out.
I doubted Hrungnir was going to stand while TJ sniped at him from a safe distance. I also doubted any of us would be doing much laughing today. But I didn't want to spoil TJ's pre-combat buzz. I turned to the ceramic warrior.
So, what's going on with Pottery Barn Guy? Why is he still in pieces?
Alex beamed.
Pottery Barn? Good name. But let's not assume Pottery Barn's gender.
Okay.
Wish me luck.
She took a deep breath, then traced her fingers across the ceramic warrior's two faces. The ceramic pieces clattered and flew together as if they'd been magnetized. Pottery Barn sat up and focused on Alex. The faces were still hardened clay, but the frozen twin sneers suddenly seemed angrier, hungrier. The right side's eye sockets glowed with golden light.
Yes!
Alex exhaled with relief.
Okay. Pottery Barn is non-binary, as I suspected. Preferred pronouns are they and them. And they are ready to fight.
Pottery Barn jumped off the table. Their limbs grinded and scraped like stones against cement. They stood about 8 feet tall, which was plenty scary to me. But I wondered if they stood a chance against whatever clay warrior Hrungnir had created. Pottery Barn must have sensed my doubt. They turned their faces toward me and raised their right fist. A heavy clay vase glazed blood red.
Stop! Alex ordered. He's not the enemy!
Pottery Barn turned to Alex as if asking, You sure about that?
Maybe they don't like garlic,
Alex speculated.
Magnus, finish that bagel quickly and let's get on the road. We can't keep our enemies waiting.